Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind The Canary, Britain's leading independent news site. I'm Kerri-Anne Mendoza, The Canary's co-founder and editor-in-chief. Each week we bring you a look behind the scenes at the biggest stories of the last 7 days. And today we look at how small acts of courage change the world. 20th century cultural anthropologist Margaret Mead once said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." Today, we're going to be looking at some stories from the last week, which make you think, wow, Margaret was bang on. And the first story is my own, and one which resonates with me as a woman of colour. Monday the 16th of October was an important anniversary. It was 49 years since African-American athletes Carl Olsen Smith gave the Black Power salute at the 1968 Mexico Olympics. No doubt you've seen the photograph. Two black men raising their black glove fists from the medal podium in power and defiance.
We felt like the power sign, most people felt like, you know, when you say power, they think about destructive, tear it down, burn it down. But it wasn't about that. It was like this five individuals of color. Both of them, all of them sharp, all of them have a paradigm as to how this world could be better. But not one of them could step out from the five and think that he can move a pebble by himself. We needed to come together in terms of being unified to do something. So when these five individuals realized this and came together, then that's where the power comes in, because now they have enough power and a vision to move a mountain opposed to trying to move this pebble. That's what we were trying to illustrate with the glove and the fist.
What fewer people know is the bravery and tragedy of the third man in the picture, the white guy standing with them. So the white guy is Peter Norman, an Australian athlete who won the silver medal in the 200 metres at the 1968 Mexico Olympics. His medal-winning time remains the Australian record over 40 years later. And in Mexico City on the 16th of October 1968, Norman stood in solidarity with Smith and Carlos. In fact, he gave Carlos and Smith the black gloves and wore an Olympic Project for Human Rights badge of justice and equality. But his choice to ally himself with the movement for ethnic equality won him no favours at home. With Australia's historic and current oppression and exclusion of Indigenous people, it was a spotlight the National Government and Olympic Committee of Australia did not want shone on their activities. So instead, they ostracised Norman. Despite him qualifying for the 1972 Olympics, Australia refused his entry to the Games. He never ran for his country at another Olympics. Norman's brother Laurie told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, "He qualified for both the 100 and 200 metres for the Munich Games, but just wasn't selected. I guess that could be considered as a ban, but he was pretty disappointed by that." And while Carlos and Smith became figureheads of the US civil rights movement, few Australians ever learned the name Peter Norman. Speaking out against his treatment, John Carlos said, "If we were getting beat up, Peter was facing an entire country and suffering alone." After suffering a career-ending Achilles injury in 1985 and struggling to find work, Norman slipped into depression and addiction. But he continued to fight inequality in his country, speaking against the treatment of Indigenous Australians. He died of a heart attack in 2006, aged just 64, but Carlos and Smith travelled to Australia to serve as pallbearers at his funeral. Norman's son went on to make the film Salute to honour the courage of Carlos and Smith and of his father who stood with them. And in 2012, the Australian government issued a formal apology to Peter Norman for his treatment. During his speech, Australian federal lawmaker Andrew Lee, member of the Labour Party, told Parliament, "After Carlos forgot his gloves, Norman came up with the idea that the two Americans should share the one pair of gloves. A protest like this, on a global stage, had never been done before. At the time, it was electrifying. Racist slurs were hurled at Smith and Carlos. International Olympic Committee President Avery Brundage, a man who'd had no difficulty with the Nazi salute being used in the 1936 Olympics, insisted the two be expelled. In that moment, Norman advanced international awareness for racial equality.
The apparent treatment of Peter Norman, symbolic of the attitude of the late 60s and early 70s, the view that sport and politics shouldn't mix. In the early 1970s, a group of brave protesters took a stand against apartheid in South Africa, interrupting games played by white-only sporting teams. History has vindicated those anti-apartheid protesters, and history has vindicated Peter Norman. I'm grateful that his 91-year-old mother, Thelma, his sister, Elaine Ambler, and her husband, Michael, can be here today. Every Olympic Games produces moments of heroism, humanity, and humility. Its motto is Citius Altius Fortius, swifter, higher, stronger. In 1968, Peter Norman exemplified this. Swifter because of his record that still stands, higher because he stood tall that day, and stronger because of the guts it took to make a stand. In the simple act of wearing that badge, Peter Norman showed the world he stood for racial equality. He showed us that the actions of one person can make a difference. And it's a message that echoes down to us today. Whether refusing to tolerate a racist joke or befriending a new migrant, each of us can and all of us should be a Peter Norman in our own lives.
And his old ally Carlos had words on the matter too, saying, "There's no one in the nation of Australia that should be honoured, recognised, appreciated more than Peter Norman for his humanitarian concerns, his character, his strength, and his willingness to be a sacrificial lamb for justice." The Australian Olympic Committee continues to deny it mistreated Norman in any way. Carlos and Smith also paid a high price for the protest. Both men were evicted from the Olympic Village and condemned by the athletic community. And when they arrived home in the US, they were met with abuse and death threats. Time magazine wrote of their stand, "Faster, higher, stronger. Stronger is the motto of the Olympic Games. Angrier, nastier, uglier," better describes the scene in Mexico City last week. Amid the immense pressure, Carlos's wife Kim committed suicide. Reflecting on the devastating aftermath, Carlos remains defiant. He says, "It lasted for about 35 years. You couldn't find a job. Friends who you thought were your friends turned their backs on you. Any money you had in the bank was starting to dissipate. It affected my wife to the point where she couldn't deal with it anymore and took her life. But I tell people, everything that happened, it could have happened 1,000 times over and I wouldn't have changed it." Today, Carlos remains a high-profile figure in social justice movements. He travels the world as an elder with a story. And in this writer's opinion, the world is a better place for having him in it. The story of Carlos, Smith and Norman remains as powerful today as in 1968. It is the story of human beings standing for one another, whatever the consequences, and of bearing those consequences with dignity and fortitude. It's also a reminder that such courage is not restricted to the pages of our history. It's happening across the country and across the world, right now, and we can all be a part of it.
At the same time, cynics might say that you've got it all. You've got publicity, you've got medals, you've got martyrdom as well. What do you say to that?
I can't eat that, and the kids around my block, they grew up with me, they can't eat it. And the kids that's going to grow up after them, they can't eat publicity, they can't eat gold medals, as Tommy Smith said. All we ask for is equal chance to be a human being. And as far as I see now, we're 5 steps below the ladder. And every time we try and touch the ladder, they put their foot on our hands and don't want us to climb up.
Here to bring you some stories of modern-day courage and defiance are the Canary's UK editor, Beck Sumner, and journalist Steve Topple. Welcome, team.
Hello. Hello.
Steve, let's start with you.
One of the stories I wrote about this week was the government is once again being taken to court over one of its most controversial policies. Now, I say once again taken to court. Before we started recording, I took on the mammoth task of totting up exactly how many times the Conservative government has been taken to court this year. It was quite a challenge, to say the least. They've been in court over air pollution, over climate change, over fracking, over the bedroom tax, over the benefit cap, over the work capability assessment, and over Southern Rail,
wow,
by my reckoning. However, this latest court action from the Child Poverty Action Group, who are a prominent charity in the UK, very vocal about policies relating to austerity and specifically welfare. This latest action is specifically regarding the two-child limit on tax credits and universal credit. Mm-hmm. So for anyone who doesn't know, George Osborne put in the budget in 2015 that from April 2017, any child that was born and had two siblings or more, the parents of that child would not be entitled to any additional help because they now have three or more children. So, for example, if a child was born on the 29th of May 2017 and they already had a brother and a sister, the parents in that family or guardians would not get child tax credit for that third child. Under universal credit, the parents or guardians would not get an increased amount of the family element of universal credit.
Right.
So Child Poverty Action Group have obviously kicked off about this, as did many other people. The policy is extremely controversial, not least for the so-called rape clause in it, which states that women who have become pregnant because of the fact they were raped by a man would have to essentially prove to either the Department or Work for Work and Pensions or Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs that they were raped, the reasons, and so on and so forth, to be able to get the money they're entitled to. But
wow,
the CPAG, Child Poverty Action Group, are bringing this case more because they say that the government is firstly in breach of human rights laws regarding the right to family life and the rights for children, but also more broadly under the UN's whole convention on the rights of a child, saying that the discriminatory treatment of this policy literally cannot be justified. They cite a lot of facts and figures, most notably that the policy, the IFS, Institute for Fiscal Studies, is forecasting will make 600,000 three-child families $2,500 a year worse off. 300 families with four or more children will lose up to £7,000 a year, and they're also saying that nearly a quarter of a million additional children will be pushed into poverty because of this. Now, the irony with this policy, which is the same with countless Conservative-led policies, are that the families that are affected by this are mostly in work. The government says it's doing this to try and encourage more people to get into work. 65% of the families that will be affected by the policy already have at least one member of that family working,
right,
which the Child Poverty Action Group says is logically flawed in its entirety. So the CPAG are bringing a judicial review, hopefully with a full court hearing, to have this policy thoroughly looked at. A judicial review means that the government basically is pulled up in court and has to answer questions regarding the effectiveness and, in CPAG's opinion, the logic of the policy. This is quite a big action, but again, it's not the first action we've seen, as I said in the introduction, relating to welfare. We've had actions around the bedroom tax where courts have ruled that it has breached, as CPAG say, UN rights of a child because it is pushing children into poverty. We've had the same on the benefit cap, and the same judgment with that as well was citing the UN rights of the child. So we've been here before, but this is slightly different because CPAG are a big organisation. They're one of the sort of leading charities in this country on poverty and austerity. And for them to be moving to take a legal process regarding a welfare policy, it's quite a big deal.
Fantastic. And what's been the reaction to this news, Steve? Have we heard anything from the government on their view? Kind of what's the view of the legal community? What's happening out there?
Oh, look, I mean, the Department for Work and Pensions, I like have a red phone to these people now. They must have, I'm on some list somewhere in their office because I spend half my time speaking to them. Their response was, I quote, "This reform ensures people on benefits make the same choices as those supporting themselves solely through work. But we have always been clear this will be delivered in the most effective, compassionate way with the right safeguards in place," which is essentially nonsense.
Yeah.
But the general, I was chatting to Peter Stevanovich, very prominent lawyer. We all know him. Yeah. about this legal action. Just I was chatting to him via social media, and he says there is grounds to answer here, because it's a tangible thing that the CPAG are saying, because it's quantified, if you like, yeah, with the figures from the IFS. That gives it more leverage and more of a chance of going through, if you like. So it is important. And also, if we look historically at the cases I mentioned at the start of my piece, the Southern Rail one, for example, the Association of British Commuters, quite a well-known now commuter organisation led by passengers, spent months and months and months on a judicial review of the Department for Work and Transport's conduct relating to the Southern Rail franchise. Mm-hmm. Loads of work, countless reports, court date after court date after court date. And they eventually had a win with that. They forced the Department for Transport to back down. The DFT pulled out of a judicial review at the last minute and fined Southern Rail just under £14 million to avoid going to court. And it wasn't very well publicised, but it shows that these kind of court actions do get small wins in the end. If the case surrounding them is watertight and it's quantifiable, which Southern Rails was, and as I say, the Child Poverty Action Group, their case is quantifiable, then these cases have a chance of actually making a difference.
Absolutely, Steve. And I think, you know, the point that you've sort of touched upon, but I just kind of reinforce, is also the drip effect of these court cases. You know, you have people, I think people can feel frustrated sometimes that they've put all of this effort and, you know, time and energy kind of into these court cases, and it feels like we get little to nothing at the end of them. But of course, we're forgetting in that the accumulative effect of court case after court case. And, you know, part of the reason we're in the situation that Theresa May is in now, in a fairly enfeebled position, and who knows really how long this government is going to last, is because of every single group up to now, actually, that's taken the time and the effort to put through these court cases and just gradually unpick kind of the nonsense behind them.
No, absolutely. It has like a snowballing effect, if you like, on undermining the government and their position. Every little case feeds into a bigger picture of the weakness of the Conservatives, the weakness of their policies, and especially the weakness of Theresa May's position. It builds up eventually, and history has shown this on numerous occasions. Eventually something will probably have to give, whether it be Theresa May's leadership or the actual government, remains to be seen. But yeah, I agree. It culminates as it being one issue eventually, if you like, and that is of completely undermining what the government are trying to do.
Absolutely. And with this stuff, you genuinely do. You just never know which issue it is which is going to light the powder keg. You know, yeah. I can remember that, you know, sort of in the 80s, you felt like Thatcher was just, you know, never going to go, you know, and the Tories were never going to go. And, you know, and ultimately there will be a straw that breaks the camel's back. Hopefully this is it. I mean, you couldn't pick a better issue.
If not that, there's a lot of people are saying that universal credit could be that spark, if you like, that is going to be Theresa May's poll tax moment, because of the anger and vitriol that is now surrounding universal credit and the condemnation from across the political spectrum, not just opposition parties and social organisations.
Absolutely. And I think that's what we need, is that coming together against this stuff. Brilliant. Thank you for that, Steve. It's a great story, and I know that you're going to keep on it. So readers of the Canary, keep at the website and you're going to see that story unfold. Steve's been awesome in covering these court cases actually all year. And the Conservatives aren't only coming under fire in court, but in their own constituencies. Bex, what's happening?
Well, yeah, so I went along to a rally in Haverford West in South West Wales in mid-October. It was part of the Unseat campaign, which is basically a larger campaign spearheaded by Momentum and journalist Owen Jones. And they're out to unseat 8 high-profile Tory MPs.
Oh my God, this is amazing. Who are they, Bex? Who are they?
Who are the MPs?
Who are the MPs?
Well, the one I went to was Stephen Crabb. I don't know if you remember him. I think he's the shortest lived welfare minister since 1945. he's had various controversies in his past, but there's basically seven ministers or former ministers. There's Justine Greening, wow. Minister for Women and Inequalities. There's Amber Rudd, Home Secretary. There's Boris Johnson, Foreign Secretary. Anna Soubry, Ian Duncan Smith, Philip Davies, Grant Shapps, and Stephen Crabb. So all really familiar household names, all high profile. And the other thing they have in common, apart from being high profile and conservative, is that they're all sitting on wafer-thin majorities. Their majorities were slashed between 2015 and 2017.
Wow.
So the campaign is about, you know, nobody knows when the next election is going to be called, and Labour's on a permanent campaign footing. Prepared. And so the campaign is about focusing on these eight seats and unseating them. And it was quite a fantastic rally, actually. I've been going to protests and rallies, 25 years or something. I'm old. This one genuinely left me quite inspired and hopeful and optimistic. It began with training. So hundreds, well, I don't know how many people went to the training, definitely dozens from the photos. Began with training, which Owen Jones led, and it was training people to go out door knocking in constituencies, because a lot of people are getting involved for the first time.
That's really interesting. So actually training people up to be a part of the political movement.
Exactly.
And be effective at what they're trying to do.
Exactly. So, and then they all actually went out on a mass door knock around Haverford West. And they were reporting that people were turning Labour. You know, the majority at the moment, I think, what's Crabb's majority at the moment? It's 314.
Oh.
So it won't take much.
No. It's like a less than a school year.
Yeah. And it finished with a rally in Castle Square, which the organisers say was the biggest rally since the suffragettes were there more than 100 years ago. It's a tiny little square, but it was absolutely packed. It was brilliant. And, you know, people of all ages, it was great. There were kids there. There were retired people there. And the speakers really reflected that. There were speakers. What I loved about it is it wasn't just a Labour thing. There were Labour speakers there, but there were also Green Party speakers there. There were union speakers there. There were people from independent campaigning groups like Disabled People Against the Cuts speaking, WASPI speaking, amazing local members of, you know, civil society, local campaigners that were, you know, totally inspiring. And they're all coming together.
That's fantastic.
With one goal and stuff. The speakers were really quite amazing, actually. There were some heartbreaking stories. So Grenville Ham, who's the leader of the Green Party, he was talking about when he had an accident and he had to learn to walk and talk again.
Wow.
And the DWP told him to come back for their help only once he could talk properly because they couldn't understand him.
What?
So, yeah. So that was the start of his journey into politics.
Wow.
And Paul Rutherford, another local man, had a similar story. You might have heard of him. He's a local anti-bedroom tax campaigner.
I do.
But he ended up in the Supreme Court because they were trying to secure care for their grandson who had very high need cares and needed a living carer. And they got hammered by the bedroom tax. The government actually told him that having a carer was, and I quote, a lifestyle choice. So he didn't stop fighting, took it to the Supreme Court and won. So that was another amazing story. But what I really, really, really loved about the day was that it was all about solutions. It wasn't just about slamming Stephen Crabb or the Conservatives. So yeah, Paul Rutherford took his fight through the courts and he won. Grenville Ham, the guy who'd had the accident, decided to fix things by getting involved politically, and he became, you know, Wales Green Party leader.
Wow.
Karen Passmore, who is another speaker from Disabled People Against the Cuts, she was talking about the importance of direct action, and they've had some serious successes with direct action at DPAC.
They really have, actually. I think they've done more than possibly any other group to raise awareness of the impact of austerity on sick and disabled people. Just extraordinary. I mean, those of you who are listening, if you have not yet come across Deepak, I'll be surprised, but you need to go and check out the website. We'll put it in the show notes. Just an extraordinary group of people.
Totally seconded. They're fantastic. They're so inspiring. And then there was Labour's Elinid Morgan, who talked about the importance of ordinary people going door knocking, as we were talking about earlier. Mark Evans from Unison, he had another completely different solution, which was calling on councils to form a mass movement by refusing to implement cuts, basically.
Oh, do you know what? I've been hearing about this. This seems to be bubbling up at the moment. I really want this to happen. I think that could be some real great direct action from local councils there.
Yeah, exactly. You'd need a few, you know, some Labour-led, some Pride-led, you know, you'd need a few, and then it would be up and running.
Absolutely.
And I don't doubt that some unions would be lending their support there. And then finally, Owen Jones finished speaking, and he was talking about, you know, the importance of having an inspiring message building an alternative, you know, via a movement from below. So it was the focus was really, really positive. I wasn't the only one who felt that. I don't think as we were leaving, we passed a couple of passers-by. They were elderly couple, quite well healed. I was there thinking, conservative voters, I wonder what they're making of all this. And they'd watched a bit of Jones's speech. And as my partner and I were passing, they were just, he turned to his wife and just went, "What a wave of optimism. I think they might win." And it was,
I think that's,
you're thinking that.
Absolutely. I think that is palpable everywhere at the moment, of just this sense of all of the things we've been through together. You know, a lot of us have kind of met each other through activism or, you know, local engagement. It's sort of like almost these things happening individually. So it's something happens to a person that is either personal to them, or it's personal to someone they know, or it's just an issue that it's a die-in-a-ditch issue for them. And it kind of has them go, "I need to do something about this." And then they get in connection with all of these other people thinking the same. And suddenly they go from feeling kind of isolated, disempowered and angry to actually feeling like there's a point. actually a point to their existence, which is to make this world a better place so that doesn't happen to anybody else.
Yeah, exactly. And you think about the impacts that cuts and conservative policies are having on millions and millions of individuals around the country. Yeah. And all of them going through different experiences. Some being made homeless or seriously worried about homelessness, some having their benefits slashed, some having being sanctioned. A lot of people are getting politicised, and then they're connecting, and then stuff happens.
Yeah. I think you just gave the equation for, for positive change.
Politicised plus meeting equals stuff happening, yeah.
Fantastic. Bex, it's brilliant to cover that. It's like, it's hugely exciting. Again, in the show notes, we'll give readers a link to your article so that they can find out how they can get involved. Because, guys, this could be happening in your area.
Exactly. There's more events coming up. There's an Unseat Boris Johnson one in late October. So yeah, go to the show notes and we'll send you a link to the Unseat website.
Fantastic. And people, honestly, get out there, particularly if you think there's no point. I mean, that's the thing I would say. If you are listening to this and thinking, just another thing, there's no point. It is precisely you that needs to go to one of these things, because you do not understand the shot in the arm of just like hope and passion and energy that you get from actually witnessing just how many other people are engaged in this. Like, you're not on your own. You aren't the only person sat there thinking that this is terrible and stuff needs to change. There are all of these other fantastic people that are working really hard to make that happen too. So get out there, go along, even if it intimidates you, the idea of going to one of these things, do. You'll start off probably like me, sitting on your hands in a corner, and by the end you'd have made 5 new best friends. And help change the world.
Exactly.
There you go. Thanks, Bex, for giving us that story. It really is fantastic news. And obviously, keep reading The Canary, because we will be covering this all the way through. Hopefully, not for very long, because hopefully soon enough, we'll have a new general election and we can get rid of these people permanently. that's us done for another week at Canary Pod. Please make sure you follow us at Canary Pod on Twitter and use the hashtag Canary Pod to carry on the discussion. We'll see you next week. Until then, remember, don't get angry, get involved.